Hello there. My name is Chris Cook and welcome to TW Talks, the interviews podcast from 3 weeks Edinburgh. We are at Edinburgh Festival 2024, sitting in the lounge at Assembly George Square, right next to the club bar and all the studio venues. The festival is very much happening around us as we speak, and I am chatting to comedians who are performing at this year's Fringe. Today, Will Owen, whose show at the Fringe this year is called Like Nobody's Watching and is something of a celebration of the reality, talent and daytime TV shows he loved growing up. We are going to talk past, present and future, the story so far, this year's show and what is happening next. So I am still here in the secret corner of Assembly George Square with my next guest, who's joined me, another performer at this year's Edinburgh Festival. Will Owen is with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to find out more about your show this year. But of course, the format is past, present, future. So we'll definitely talk about this year's show in a moment. But let's do the story so far.
Sure, chronological.
From the start of you performing comedy to this year's show, where did it all begin?
So I started performing comedy at university. I did some sketch comedy because I wanted to be an actor. And then when I arrived at university, it became clear that that wasn't a skill that I had, to my sort of shock horror. Sketch comedy was kind of the happy middle ground where I continued to be a bad actor, but you could kind of get away with it because like you had jokes and you were kind of eking laughs out of people in the writing as well as the performing. I mean, some of it was still terrible anyway. But I think I just made loads of friends doing it and I really enjoyed that medium. And I kind of had been much more in theatery stuff like in school. I mean, not only in an am-dram sense, but I'd always done drama and loved it. But comedy just kind of felt like a perfect combination of writing, directing. So at the end of uni, I thought, okay, I hate doing sketch, but I love doing comedy. So I'll do stand-up. And then, of course, the coronavirus hit.
Okay, so yeah, let's put some dates into this. So okay, you're at university.
I think I did my first sketch in 2018.
So that was your journey from being acting, theatre, hang on, sketch comedy.
Yeah.
Then you'd got the realisation that actually stand-up was what you wanted to do, just as every venue in the world shut down.
Exactly. So I think I did one gig in March 2020 and it went really well. And I was like, oh my God. Stand up.
Although March 2020, that might have been a spreader event.
Yeah, so true. Sorry, everyone. That probably was really terrible. It was great for my career.
Glad it went well.
Terrible for society, but great for me. Yeah, maybe it was February covering my tracks. Anyway, so I did that and I was like, great. And then COVID hit. And then I had a weird thing because I graduated in COVID. So I never really got another job. But there obviously were no stand up gigs. So I was just kind of doing random, like sort of temporary bits, or like I worked in a deli for a while and all the time sort of thinking like I want to be a stand-up. So when it came to what must be summer 2021, then I started doing a few London gigs and then I built my way up there.
And do you think that obviously you'd made that decision towards the latter part of your university time that I'm going to be a stand-up, you did that show in early 2020, and then the fact that it then was all forced on hold for a year.
Yeah.
Did that have an impact on how you were making comedy when suddenly the opportunities were back?
I think
you had a year of thinking what this...
Yeah, I think it meant actually like I was too tight at the start, which I like, as in, and I mean that in a bad way because people say like tight five, obviously that's a good thing. But I think I had like so thought about what I wanted, what kind of comedy I wanted to make. And I'd watched so much of like people that
This was during the year.
This was during the year, yeah. And like all my favorite kind of comedians are... a lot of like Brooklyn and LA stand-ups, who people like Kat Cohen, who's at the Fringe this year, Pat Regan, John Early, who are like persona-driven stand-up. And so as they've got really brilliantly written jokes, but it's driven from a kind of persona and character more than it's kind of like telling a story, for example. I think I was in a weird position of like, I wanted to kind of, that was what I found interesting in comedy. But then I had these really tightly scripted jokes that I'd basically spent a year writing. So I think in a way, the first 18 months I did it in London, I was just kind of loosening up. And actually having done this show as an hour rather than a short set, I think my persona has evolved so much because I've been able to kind of loosen up.
So let's talk about that year, 18 months when you started. So the venues of London reopened up.
Yes.
And you were doing the open mic circuit. Yeah. So, just the first time you did that, you just rock up, you go on stage and you...
Yeah, I mean, the first...
Bearing in mind, by this point, I guess you've been writing these jokes for a year.
Yeah.
saying them to yourselves, yeah, and suddenly you've got an audience to deliver them to.
Yeah, the first one that I did was in a pub in East, like the depths of East London. And I don't think, I think one audience member was there because it was an open mic night and the rest were comedians and we had to sit socially distanced. And I think the football was still on at the pub. Like, so I really like, it was a very odd scenario where it was kind of like sort of like Quaker meeting setup of everyone being sat in a big circle spaced apart. And then someone would just come up and speak and some, it would sometimes get a response and sometimes it wouldn't. And so that was actually quite good because I was so nervous. I remember like I really felt sick going to that gig, but because it was so weird, it kind of got the first gig nerves out of the way without it really counting as a gig. Yeah, because it went horribly, horribly
wrong. You could blame it on the
Exactly. Well, it just kind of like...
Because like that sounds like a really difficult environment, even for a very well-established stand-up.
I mean, it was the kind of environment where I was like, you can't really say anything constructive about it. Like, no offense to it, but just because of COVID and everything like that, it was just so weird that like, you know, if it went well, that isn't necessarily testament to the jokes either. So I think that was like a good way to actually like get the ball rolling. And then I just started to do more and more gigs. And then I started to do like the new act competitions that there's quite a lot in London, which were really good because you then meet people who are like really at the top of their game.
So how long have you been doing the open mic spots before you were like, okay, I'm going to go and try and do these?
Well,
these
I did all of them straight away because I was ambitious.
I guess you'd had 18 months of sitting around. You wanted to get
I know, going. Yeah. And I think I'd like seen like my friends do them and I was like, cool, this is clearly like how to kind of like get the ball rolling with meeting people and getting gigs and stuff. And I didn't get to the final of any in that first year, but it was still, I'm still really glad I did them because I made them, I met the most people doing them and I still got loads of gigs from doing them.
And I get, you know, for some people who are right now at that early stage, I mean, just explain the mechanics of, well, how are there forms you fill out? Are there websites you go to?
Oh, yeah. So in terms of the admin of it, yeah, that's good. They, you do normally need to fill out a form.
Yeah.
Most of them, yeah, have a website. To be fair, one of the ones I did, I don't think happens anymore, which was at somewhere called Two North Down. That was a really good one. And that has a really nice mix of people and really proper industry judges.
And you said one of the benefits of doing that, you know, is, well, meeting two groups of people. A is industry people who you might want to get bookings from or help from, and just other comedians.
Yeah, that's the main thing, is meeting the other comedians. And you like, you see, because there's, in those competitions, they get through 20 acts a night because there's so many applicants. So you have this massive pool of people that you're like stood backstage with. And I remember always going to one and being like, gosh, these people are so, do they hate me? And then afterwards I'd be like, oh no, everyone was just nervous.
Yeah.
But because I felt really new, I was like, oh, they all like are just like not interested in me. But actually everyone's just nervous no matter how sort of far into their careers they were. And yeah, it's just a good way to like see the biggest range of styles. And I think at that early stage it's good to play some like a venue that's a comedy venue, proper comedy venue, has an audience there that know about comedy and has, and it encourages you to do better when someone comes up and does like a really solid type five. Because I think also with open mics, I would get nervous, so I would just kind of like do a middle point of what I'd planned to do, which I could kind of get away with. But then in the competitions, it kind of made me like, I guess, up my game. That sounds so like, I didn't think it was that considered. I would really recommend doing those if people are starting comedy and interested in.
You mentioned some of your influences, and also once you were doing those open mics and the awards, your the way you performed changed quite a bit.
Yeah,
sort of loosened up was the words you used. And I mean, as of now, you know, what, if, I know this is a horrible journalist question, no one likes to answer. What kind of, describe the kind of comedy you are performing.
Okay, the thing is also, I feel like every time I describe it, I'm so scared to use a word that has connotations to different people. I suppose there's kind of like a listlessness to my comedy, but there's also like, it's also, especially the show I'm doing now is very like put on a show. I'd say it's like an entertainment, like a kind of like, there's like a Mr. Saturday Night element to the persona, but from a kind of like young, slightly unmotivated or like uninspired, dare I say Gen Z, persona.
So you're sort of contrasting those two things.
I'd say, yeah, those two. And I think they kind of like happen simultaneously. Like I think, it's also very silly. And I don't know, I think an interesting word is camp. I would say it's quite camp, but not in a kind of like, you know, Kenneth Williams manner. There's an irony that underpins everything that I say. And I think that's also sometimes I know there's bits in my show where I would say something earnest and by the end, and most days that will then get a laugh because the tone has kind of been set. And some days though, people haven't gone on board with the tone that I have set and it will just get like really earnest whoops and cheers, which is also nice, but it's incorrect. And I'm like, God, thank you
for the applause. Yeah. You've got it wrong.
No, I'm like, this audience has taken this as an earnest sort of like coming of age show. Yeah. And okay, I guess I'm glad that they're responding still in some way or another, but it's funny to me. There's a bit where I have a joke about being gay towards the end of my show that's been very much covered earlier in the show. And when I was doing a work in progress, these two drunk women came in just for the last 10 minutes. And I said, I'm gay. And they like both like started whooping and cheering. And then it was very funny for all the rest of us that had seen the rest of the show, because they just heard that and were like, oh my God, this is so empowering. But that's obviously not quite the tone.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about, so is there a premise for the show?
So the premise is, it's to do with my obsession with kind of, I guess, mindless reality shows, competition shows, and how exciting and thrilling I used to find them and still find them. And like, I'm talking like things like Strictly Come Dancing, The X Factor, anything that has a kind of
vote. So you're critiquing them, but as someone who actually really...
Yeah, as in, I don't even know if I'm critiquing them. I think I'm just saying that I love them. But it's kind of like, I think when I was younger, I just loved the like monocultural feeling of being like everyone is sat on their sofas watching this.
The event TV.
Yeah, exactly. Event TV that we don't really have as much anymore, which came back actually in COVID, I feel like, with those shows. There was a lot of people would talk about. And it's kind of like happening with like The Traitors, I guess, now, those kind of shows, like Water Cooler Chat.
Yeah.
And I think it's like, yeah, I've got a real affection for that genre. And it's kind of like, I guess it's contrasting like the sparkly shininess of those shows and the kind of like listlessness of my early 20s existence.
And was that stuff you were talking about generally in the routines you were doing? Or when you decided to do the 1 hour, was that like, no, actually, that's the topic I want to...
I think that was the topic I came... that came out of early work in progress versions. So in my short sets, I never really covered TV stuff. And then I had a bit that's now in the show about basically like begging my mum to let me vote for Pixie Lott in 2014 on Strictly Come Dancing. And people just responded really well to it. And it felt truest to kind of like the voice I was trying to create, which sounds pretentious, but it is true. So that kind of is something that I just brought out, and I like worked with directors and stuff, so that was something we kind of brought out over the course of the year and began to kind of take the shape of the show. And I think right up until like July we were playing around with the end, and like the show's got quite a distinctive ending which people have liked. But we were playing around with that a lot and seeing how we could kind of sew it in, because I think also obviously in Edinburgh maybe there's an audience expectation of like a turn at the end of the show, and there is a turn at the end of the show, but I hope it's unexpected and silly, but also satisfying.
And how did comparing, I mean, everybody who's been on the sort of stand-up comedy journey, particularly if they have an Edinburgh-centric career, that first one-hour show is, it's a big landmark, but also it's quite different to everything that's gone before.
Yeah.
How did you find that experience of doing the one-hour solo show?
I found it, like, I've enjoyed it the most of anything I've ever done, I think. Like, I'm so lucky that it's just been a really pleasurable experience. And it's obviously been so stressful, and, like, everything around it is horrifying and scary and stressful, but the show itself I've, like, really loved. And I think because I've just... focus on the details of it so much, which has been like so creatively satisfying, and the audiences here have just like responded so well to it, and I think have really like understood what I was trying to do with it sort of like thematically and feeling wise. I think what I found so hard to reconcile for a long time was that I love these kind of like big entertainers, like I love Graham Norton, I think Alan Carr's hilarious, like Judy Love is one of my favorite comedians that are kind of like Saturday night entertainers, TV entertainers. And then I also love everyone I was saying before, that these kind of like much more alternative comedians are doing that like a mainstream audience wouldn't necessarily like flock to in the same way. I hope they didn't mind saying that. I think it's a compliment.
They don't want the main.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so I think I was kind of like wondering how to marry those two things, and I think it's a, I'm pleased with the start of how I have. And I don't know. Like, I think it's kind of like I'm trying to like bring entertainment back I guess.
I was going to say, well, you, obviously you mentioned with the sort of the big reality shows, talent shows, that sort of thing. Because you sort of said, in terms of the having that event TV, I mean, maybe the period which of you growing up. I don't know. Maybe I'm just being a tedious journalist here, but maybe was that the peak of that kind of
TV? Oh my God, 100%. Yeah. So we had like, because I remember Joe McKeldry winning the X Factor. I don't know if that means anything.
It does indeed.
Yeah. So that, I remember that had 18 million viewers or something, the final of that. Like, and that was when I must have been maybe like 8 or 9. So that was really like family sitting down on a Saturday, like not having anywhere else to be, being at home on a Saturday night and sitting down and like watching that. And I think all those kind of big reality TV moments, I was very much watching when I was growing up. And like Love Island, I was 16 when that started. So I was kind of there from the beginning of that. So I like have been very engaged in all of the shows that have now kind of found a place in culture, for better or for worse. So I think, and that's kind of what there's an element of like nostalgia in the show as well, which is also crazy because there's jokes about the X Factor, and obviously the X Factor hasn't been on TV for like, I don't know, probably 6 years or something now, and I fell from the kind of top of the agenda years before that. But it's kind of about like nostalgia, and yeah, I hope that people are happy to hear an Olly Murs joke in 2024.
Well, I suppose, you know, a lot of people in the audience, I mean, and even if, I guess there was that period where sort of Simon Cowell was at its peak and Strictly was at its peak, where even if you didn't watch those shows, you could not ignore them. I guess that was the thing, wasn't it? And I guess Traitors maybe has a lot of that spilled over onto social media, hasn't it? But I'm not quite sure, quite at the level that you could not own a TV, you could deliberately not watch TV, and yet you still knew what was going on with those shows.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's kind of part of it as well.
And do you think they'll come back? Do you want them to come back to this level they were in, say, 2012?
I don't know. Like, I do. I think, like I said to you before, like, I like the monocultural element of it. And I don't know if they'll come back because I think that mainly because, like, the sensibility has changed. And, like, a lot of what made the kind of, like, schadenfreude of watching those shows, you know, in X Factor, it was, like, gladiatorial. There was, like, bits, it was kind of people baying for blood as much as they were.
Well,
like,
and also, I guess, in the certainly the late 2000s, there was that almost, certainly with the early episodes in the series, there was almost the freak show element of it, which I think with hindsight, we've now looked back at and slightly cringe.
Oh my gosh, definitely. And I also think that like on X Factor, when looking back now, there would be a gay man on it every single year that would be the joke act, and no one else on it would be openly gay. And I remember one person, there was one contestant once, and it was like a media storm when he like got outed. So the sensibility was very much like male pinup for young female stars, like female pop star for young girls kind of thing. And like nothing else. And, you know, it was quite a heteronormative kind of setup. So I don't know how it would exist
of its
now.
Moment. Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. And I think, I don't know. I mean, I guess Britain's Got Talent still seems to be quite a big show that people watch. And I mean, Strictly, it's interesting because obviously at the moment it's kind of like...
But that's because the scandals have come out of that, haven't they? But I guess, but having said that, even though they are, their ratings are still, I guess, are quite impressive, but it doesn't feel like it's quite so everybody knows that show is on.
And I think that's also kind of the joke of my show is that like, I'm still talking about this. And it's like, at the time it was seen as trash TV.
Yeah.
Now, 10 years later, it's like, you need to get a life and you know, go outside kind of thing. But I don't know. I don't know. I mean, the way that people watch The Traitors now, I do think there's like that feels like it's building. And I kind of think that like the thing about social media, and I think what happened with social media and like streaming was that everyone could have an incredibly individual experience and like build their own communities that spoke to them. And everyone now is existing in a much smaller bubble because you've got choice that we didn't obviously have before. And I wonder if now like culturally there's people are hankering for those kind of communal experiences again. I think maybe COVID is another aspect of that where like, obviously now it was 3 years ago, but I don't know. And I notice it in crowds, like there's just a real feeling that everyone wants to be in a room together.
And actually, I think there is a link between those big reality talent shows 10 years ago and those sort of very mainstream entertainer comedians. And I guess one thing, not only do they bring a lot of people together, they're very cross-generational, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
In a way, because obviously some of those alternative stand-up comedians have they're brilliant and they have a very, very loyal fan base.
Yeah.
But they're not something which, you know, if you're at a family event, whatever age the person is in the room, they'll be aware. And the comedians you mentioned, the Graham Nortons of this world and those shows. And as I say, even if people don't particularly rate them.
Yeah.
They know them.
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. And I think that's a nice Well, that's also why I wanted to like really, that's why, again, when I describe my show, I'm always like, I find it so challenging because I don't want to alienate people, because I think that everyone couldn't, everyone who wants to enjoy it could. And like, we've had days where there's been some like queer people in their 20s and then like straight couples that seem to be in their 50s or 60s. Forgive me if that's wrong, then, who have all kind of come along yeah. with it. And I think that's why Graham Norton is particularly inspiring, because he's like very true to himself. And I know that like all my kind of like young gay friends who, I don't know, quite like have a particularly like ironic sense of humor, find him hilarious. And I know that also my grandma, who likes the kind of like quite mainstream shows and enjoys like quite, I guess, like straightforward and nice TV, finds him hilarious. And so I think that's like, but that's because he's been specific to who he is and he's allowed people to come up with him. And I think that's, kind of inspiring.
So you talked about the you have this theme for this show and that this isn't stuff you've been doing in your previous sets before. I mean, do you think this show predominantly works as an hour, it's a piece of work, or will you be able to pull some of the themes and some of the elements to it to do sort of, you know, club sets?
I definitely think that, I hope what it does is a kind of establish in some way or another, and however small it establishes itself, but the sense of like who I want to be as a comedian, which I think is what a debut is probably about. But I think definitely like I want to move down the kind of like mock entertainment route. I think I'm gonna, well, there's kind of there's a slight format element to my show, and like I definitely think I'd like to host kind of like entertainment and like formatty shows, as well as kind of continuing to build hours and actually seeing how I can continue to marry those two things together, the mix of kind of like broad entertainment and like confessional stand-up.
And staying with the future finally, I mean, do you have plans to take this show beyond the festival? And do you have plans for 2025?
I have plans to take this show beyond the festival. No one else.
The world needs to catch up.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone else is like, okay, what? But I hope, I mean, yeah, let's see what happens. But I would love to do it again in some other places, and I think I would like to do the Fringe again in 2025, but again I think I kind of like I'm gonna take stock at the end of the month, see what I've got out of it, who I've got out of it, and then kind of like what the right next step would be, because I also don't I want to really think creatively about the ideas that have come up in the show and like the response to it and like where I want to go from there. And so I don't want to necessarily like brush something out. But having said that, I've literally had an amazing time. And
well, no, as you say, given that you feel that this is the show where you have identified the kind of performer you want to be.
Yeah.
So I suppose, yes, let's have the festival finish, calm down. Is that okay? Now you know that, what can you do with that?
Yeah. I think what I want to do is keep making shows. So I think I want to take stock, but in a way that is like productive and pushing forward, as opposed to being like, oh, remember when I did the Fringe? Yeah, that was cool. But I don't know. I think I need, like, I might try and transfer a bit of stuff to social media and try and do some, like, I used to host a mixed bill show in London. Yeah. Like, I'd love to do stuff like that. And kind of like, I think,
well,
again,
no, it sounds like you, I mean, not that I'm planning your 2025 Fringe for you, but in addition to coming back with another hour, it does sound like somewhere in your mind, there's a format type show. And this is probably a place to be doing that sort of thing.
Right, yeah. I mean, I used to host one in which was called Abso-Frickin-Lution, and basically we'd get an audience member to tell a story from their life, which didn't go how they planned it. Like, it would, for example, someone wanted to be in High School Musical in school and then wasn't. And then at the end of the show, we reenact the moment for them and they get to like have the ending they wanted to have. So this person was in High School Musical and all the comedians play the characters that they've told in the story. And that was really fun and it was hopefully quite joyous. So that kind of thing is something that, I definitely would want to do more of.
Let's do the listings for this month. So if people are at the festival, when and where can they see you?
You can see me at 20 past 10 p.m. In The Crate, which is in Assembly George Square, and I've had my day off now, so I'm here every day till the 25th.
Till the end of the festival. Yeah. Finally, where can people find you online?
Online, on Instagram, I'm at @_WillOwen.
Simple.
Yeah,
fantastic.
Very straightforward.
Thank you for joining
me. Thank you.
Thank you.